Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's been said that couples who live together before marriage are doomed for divorce. Well, it turns out marriage may not be the be-all and end-all to reap the emotional benefits of living together. A new study suggests that young unmarried couples who live together before marriage are just as happy as those who tie the knot. Joining us now is co-author of the study and associate professor of human sciences at Ohio State University, Claire Camp Dush. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what did people think before this study? I mean, what was the conventional wisdom for the last few decades?
Well, what you'll find in textbooks is that living together before marriage is actually not good for your relationship. But I think that a lot of those data are based on samples that were living together in the 1980s and 1990s when living together was less common. And now at least 70% of couples are living together before they're married, and probably even closer to 80%. And so one thing that we wanted to do with this study is see, are these things still true now that cohabitation is so common?
And does it matter, the commonality of it?
I think it matters somewhat, at least for stigma. So back in the 1980s, if you were living together, you might have been facing some social stigma from your friends and family. Your parents might have been pressuring you to get married. And now that everyone's doing it, that's gone to the wayside somewhat, at least among your friends, probably.
How was the study conducted?
So we're using data from the National Longitudinal Survey of Youth, which is housed here at Ohio State. So it's a nationally representative study. And these people were between 11 and 14 in 1997. So they were in their 20s in the 2000s. And the sample's still being followed up. This data is a national treasure. It's having its 50th anniversary at Ohio State, the overall study. So something that Ohio State's really proud of.
Yeah, those are big deals, those longitudinal studies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What were some of the limits to the study?
Some of the limits to the study were probably that we only had measures of their mental health every 2 years. And so we would have liked to have that more often than that.
Uh-huh.
But that's probably the biggest limit to the study.
What defines good emotional health?
We're defining good emotional health on a sliding scale. So, you know, having every day feeling like you are happy and most days in a week not feeling nervous. Those are some of the hallmarks that we're using for emotional health.
Are people good reporters about their own emotional health?
I think people are good reporters about their own emotional health when they think about the past week or past 2 weeks or past month, how they've been feeling. I think people have a pretty good sense of that. So I don't really know that there's a better way. Maybe a clinical interview would be better. But when we're talking about a nationally representative sample, that's too cost, be way too expensive to do.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the health benefits of living together versus marriage. My guest is Claire Camp Dush. She is co-author of a new study on the topic and associate professor of human sciences at OSU. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. It'd be fun to hear from people who live together and then married and talk about what you found. 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You found differences, though, in men versus women. What were the gender differences?
So what we found was that for the first union, and when I say union, I'm including marriage and cohabitation, that men really only had an emotional health benefit from moving from single to marriage. And when they moved from being single to cohabiting, they didn't experience an emotional health benefit. Whereas for women, going from single into marriage or into cohabitation, they experienced emotional health benefits.
What do you make of that?
Well, we don't know a lot about gender differences in perceptions of cohabitation and marriage, but what little we do know from some qualitative work suggests that men see cohabitation more as a trial run for marriage and a testing ground for relationships, where women see it more as a stepping stone to marriage, as a precursor. So men might be going into cohabitation more questioning the relationship. Is this really what I want? Is this going to move
with this person?
Right, with this person. Mm-hmm. Whereas women are looking at it, this is what I want, but we're going to cohabit first, then we'll get married. At least that's, so we don't, I wouldn't say that we have excellent evidence of that, but we have some studies that suggest that that's the case.
It's a fine distinction.
Yeah, it really is, because they're both looking at it as a step on their relationship progression. But men definitely see this as more of a testing. We'll see what's going on here. And women, I think, are pretty committed at the point that they are moving in with somebody.
You focus on young adults. You refer to it as emerging adulthood, mm-hmm. I guess, is a way you refer to it. Is there any noticeable difference between people in that category versus people who are might be older?
Oh, I think that's an awesome question. And unfortunately, I don't think we have a lot of information on these transitions for people like, let's say, in their 50s and 60s. You know, we've heard a lot about this gray divorce revolution where more people are divorcing later in life. And after you divorce, cohabitation is much more likely in your next relationship. And so it's totally possible that we would see different effects and a different pattern of results for people in their 50s or 60s. Than what we're seeing for these young adults. So that would be a really awesome study.
Is there any, I don't know, but in this national study, there must have been some people who had children, right?
There were some people that had children. We control for having children, but we're not breaking out the parents specifically. We do know from other research that when you have a child and you're living together, like you have your child in your cohabiting relationship, that you're much more likely to dissolve your relationship than if you have a child as a married couple. And we also know also that we're calling it shotgun cohabitation is more common. So people used to get married after they had a pregnancy, and now people are much more likely to move in together. So just isolating those parents would be interesting as well. Yeah. But we know that the transition to parenthood is very stressful. So I don't know if that would be an emotional health benefit or how that would go exactly.
Has this then addressed that long-held belief by some, and I don't know where they got the idea from, but that living together before marriage makes it more likely that the relationship will end in divorce?
Well, the long-held belief came from a bunch of research on couples in the 1970s and 1980s and looking at their divorce rates. So that's where this belief comes from. And I think what this study suggests is that we need to do new research on couples that are living together in the 2000s and even later and see how it affects their relationship, because it's a very different family climate. We're in a different social climate now for couples that are living together. And like I said, there's not near as much social stigma as there once was. And so I'm not suggesting that there's going to be no effect. I think that, you know, there could still be an effect of cohabiting on your ultimate relationship outcomes. But I think we need to do more research before we can say that that's the case. And this study at least suggests that there are emotional health benefits, at least for women, of living together as well as marriage.
Did you see, or is anyone looking into whether there's a correlation of health, physical health benefits?
We didn't look at physical health benefits. One hard thing with this sample is that they're young and healthy. Mm-hmm. And so we wouldn't have a lot of variation in that. But that would definitely be something that'd be interesting to add for older adults, because women can help men monitor their health a lot, especially when people are in midlife. And so I wouldn't be surprised if there were physical health benefits for people in their 50s and 60s of moving in together, because that's probably an additional person monitoring health, and that can be beneficial.
Mm. And then also the health effects when two people split. So in this longitudinal study, you had to have seen some of that.
Yeah. So that's something actually we were really interested in. And that's a research question I'm really interested in, is does cohabitation disillusion, we kind of don't have a good word for divorce, but when you break up and you're cohabiting, does that have similar...
When you split up the album collection.
Yes. Yeah. Does that have a similar negative effect to divorce? And on some of my work of looking at parents, I found that it did have a similar negative effect looking at the mental health consequences of cohabitation disillusion and divorce. But that was all low-income parents. So one thing we wanted to do with this study is replicate those findings. Well, we couldn't because of that 2-year lag and the measure of mental health. Mm-hmm. People moved so quickly from one relationship to the next that we couldn't capture them single between these cohabiting relationships. So they would break up one cohabitation, and some of them literally in the same month would be living with someone new or within 6 months. And so we didn't have the sample size to test that. So the closest we got, which I mentioned before we got on the air, was that we were able to look at people in their second unions and compare that to people in their first unions and to when they were single. And what we found was that people experienced emotional health benefits over their first unions and over when they were single, when they moved into second marriages or second cohabitations. But that was something we were really interested in. We just didn't have the data.
Has our view of cohabitation changed? Of course it has. We're more accepting of mm-hmm. it. But does that change what it, how it manifests? Hmm. People still keep separate checking accounts, that kind of a thing. Mm. Did you get into any of those kinds of details?
Oh, gosh. I have another study I'm working on trying to look at some of those issues. And it's hard because of the data. And I'm trying to find a question about checking accounts. I think that people do combine things more now than they have previously and like buying a house.
Yeah.
So I have some evidence that cohabiting couples are more likely to buy houses together than they were, like, let's say in the 1970s. So I do think that besides the social stigma, the context of cohabitation has changed as well, where people are combining things more than they probably would have in the past. But we weren't able to look at that in the study. It was really just emotional health.
What about pets? Because when people get into relationships and they move in together, often the next step is they get a puppy together or something like that. Did you notice anything like that?
We didn't have good data on that.
Because pets are supposed to be a correlation between that and emotional well-being, too.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's interesting. Could that be the third variable in our study, that's causing all the effects as they got a pet?
First comes cohabitation, then comes the pet.
That's ironic because I have a grad student this semester that just moved in with her boyfriend. They just bought a house together. They got a pet. She seems happy. It's totally possible that that could be some driving these effects somewhat as well. I don't think that we have those kind of data, but that's an interesting idea.
So about 2 million adults, I think this is in the U.S., are affected by a divorce mm-hmm. each year. Mm-hmm. Which dating couples are most likely to make it and who are most likely to break up? Mm. Have you learned anything about that?
Well, I think that one thing that we know for sure is that education and income and employment are all associated with who's likely to stay together and who's likely to break up and also who's likely to marry. So one thing that we know in the United States is that marriage is becoming a more select status, that education, income, and employment is predicting who gets married. And people are marrying people more and more like themselves. So you have these highly educated people marrying other highly educated people. And education and stress, education reduces stress, and stress is associated with divorce. So the divorce rate has actually been declining slightly as marriage has become a more select status. I mean, of course, relationship quality and conflict, those mental health problems, mm-hmm. Poor relationship quality, high conflict, poor mental health, those all are associated with divorce as well. But now we have people selecting in, the most privileged people are selecting into marriage, and then those marriages are becoming more stable. And unfortunately, those people with less privilege are the ones that are not feeling like they have the resources necessary to get married.
Hmm. Well, thank you for sharing your insights with us. I appreciate your time today.
No problem. Thanks.
That's Claire Camp Dush. She's co-author of a study about the impact and the relative impact of cohabitating and getting married. And she's associate professor of human sciences at Ohio State University. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Every year, nearly 800,000 people in the U.S. suffer from strokes, the leading cause of serious long-term disability as well. Ohio Health last week announced that it will roll out specially equipped ambulances, staffed and stocked to provide special care for stroke patients during the critical minutes before they reach the hospital. The announcement has caused some friction in the Central Ohio healthcare community. However, Columbus Dispatch reporter Ben Southerly has been following the story. He joins us in the studio. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Good morning, Ann.
Also, mobile stroke units like the Ohio Health models already are in use across the country, including by way of the Cleveland Clinic. So joining us by phone is Cleveland Clinic neurologist Dr. Andrew Russman. Welcome to the show, Dr. Russman.
Thank you.
In general, what's the goal for having these specialized ambulances? How do they work, Dr. Russman?
Well, these specialized ambulances take a lot of the critical decision-making and resources that are involved in care of stroke patients, especially in the early period after stroke, and they put them all together in the space of an ambulance. One of the critical components of the early decision-making after stroke is having a CT scanner present in order to determine whether or not there's a bleeding-type stroke or a non-bleeding-type stroke that's present. These units function and can be successful largely because of two major components. One, that they are able to deliver care in the community without having to wait to transport the patient. That's just one aspect of their benefit. Mm-hmm. But probably the biggest benefit is not in the transport time savings, but rather the savings in efficiency that takes place on the ambulance. The CT scanner is there. The patient is within arm's reach of the CT scanner, laboratory testing, physician evaluation, nursing, all is contained and focused on stroke care in the ambulance, whereas in a traditional emergency department, those things are all not together at the same time. The neurologist or the physician that may be involved has to come to the bed space. The CT scanner is down the hall. The laboratory is in either the building over or not necessarily right next to the patient. And so time is a major factor in benefit from stroke. For each minute that the brain goes without blood flow, there's about 1.9 million nerves in the brain that are being lost and a certain degree of accelerated aging. So it's time is of the essence here. And so the mobile stroke systems try and consolidate all of those resources to become much more efficient at managing time.
How do you know when you're sending out one of these one of these specialized ambulance operations, how do you know you're sending it to the right patient at the right time?
Well, so the way that it works in the current system is that someone calls 911 and there's an identification that there may be a stroke going on, and the dispatcher pages out or calls out to the local EMS unit to be dispatched to the scene. And at the same time, simultaneously, our mobile stroke treatment unit is dispatched to the patient's home. And the EMS team arrives on scene. If it seems like this is more likely stroke symptoms than something else, the patient is then subsequently loaded onto the mobile stroke treatment unit right at their doorstep. And then the specialized team that takes care of stroke is evaluating the patient. And a physician is not physically present, but actually through a telemedicine connection, beams into the ambulance to visualize and interact with the patient and to help make that diagnosis.
There's also drugs involved, treatments possibly in the ambulance as well, right?
That's correct. Actually, one of the main focuses is identifying what early treatments are beneficial. Some of those treatments might apply to bleeding type strokes, where if people are on blood thinning medication, we'd be able to give medicines that reverse the effects of the blood thinner early. So a CT scanner on the ambulance is very helpful to identify the presence of bleeding. But the majority of patients are the non-bleeding types of strokes, where there's a blockage in a blood vessel. And the best that we can offer is if the patient is a candidate for a medication to try and bust up that clot or clot-busting medication, to deliver it to them as efficiently, as safely, as quickly as possible. And what we know is that the earlier that we can deliver that therapy, the more beneficial it is to the patient. And that if we look nationwide, we're still not very successful at delivering that clot-busting medication, which we call TPA. We're still not very successful nationwide at delivering it within our targets for time. So if we look at the latest data that's available nationally, is we're still only about half the time meeting our time target of getting the clot busting in within 60 minutes of the time that the patient presents to the door of the hospital. And so that's part of the generation for these mobile stroke units, is to create greater efficiency and to bring the decision-making and treatment capabilities to the patient's doorstep, And that way we're able to gain significant time savings. Time is so important here that even a 15-minute improvement in the time to clot-busting therapy from a study that was done on not long ago, published last year, showed that if we can deliver 15 minutes earlier the clot-busting medicine, 5% more patients go home from the hospital. 3% more patients are independent and walking at discharge. So it's not just there's not just a benefit in terms of reduced complications of these treatments. It's a direct benefit to the patient in more independence and less time in the hospital.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about specialized ambulances that would be dispatched in when there is a suspicion or symptoms that indicate a stroke. You just heard from Dr. Andrew Russman. He's a neurologist at the Cleveland Clinic. Also with us in the studio, Ben Southerly. He's a business of healthcare reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. He's been covering this issue. The announcement by Ohio Health to dispatch one of these specialized ambulances, Ben, has created some friction in the Ohio Central Ohio healthcare community. What's going on? What's the problem?
Sure. Well, basically, the announcement came last Tuesday mm-hmm. from Ohio Health, and they made the announcement in conjunction with the City of Columbus because obviously they need to coordinate their response with paramedics,
right.
With dispatchers. Right. And the announcement caught the two other adult hospital systems in town, Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center and Mount Carmel Health System, off guard, according to them. And prior to this announcement, there had been some efforts by the three hospital systems and other stakeholders to develop some stroke protocols on, when, for example, to take a stroke patient to a certain hospital, mm-hmm. for example. And the consensus wasn't arrived at. And so the systems were at a bit of an impasse. And when they reached that, it wasn't too long after that this announcement came. So that was the backstory. And then there are, I guess, some concerns that have been brought up about that this might kind of feed into an effort to maybe increase market share mm-hmm. on the part of Ohio Health, which, of course, OSU and Mount Carmel wouldn't be happy about. And then also, it's an evolving area. And so there are still a lot of questions, I think, about, is this worth the investment? The time that you save, is it worth the investment?
Because it costs a lot of money. Dr. Russman, what do one of these ambulances cost? I mean, how do we break that down?
Well, the actual development cost of the ambulance, the first unit in development, is probably somewhere right around $1 million to develop a typical unit like this. And most of that cost is the cost of the CT scanner and, to a lesser extent, some of the other equipment. That it's really the cost of a traditional ambulance plus the cost of a CT scanner and the other equipment that goes on the ambulance.
Were there similar conflicts in Cleveland? To tell you the truth, I don't know. Is there much competition in Cleveland like there is in Columbus for market share?
There is a lot of competition for market share in any community mm-hmm. In which there's more than one system, and I think competition is healthy. And the goal of this program is a collaborative one. And even though the Cleveland Clinic initiated this process, it's run through a collaborative effort with the local communities and the municipalities. And the algorithms for how people are transferred are predominantly based on patient preference. So if the patient says, I want to go to facility A, then as long as they meet the criteria for going to facility A, they're transported to facility A. And then there is some advice that goes on in an algorithm based on how severe the stroke is. We'd like the patients that are the sickest to be able to go to hospitals that are able to care for them. And there is an existing policy within specifically Cleveland EMS to transport patients to facilities that have the greatest capabilities. All the major health systems in the Cleveland area have those capabilities. The transfer or transport of patients that are being picked up by our mobile stroke treatment unit are being distributed and go to all the hospitals that participate within the Cleveland communities or municipalities that are involved, and the proportion of patients that are going one hospital versus another hospital are representative of those hospitals' market share in the community. So there has not been a redistribution of share of patients in transport.
So in Central Ohio, then, Ben Southerly, what's the problem with distribution and market share? They're not all similarly equipped?
Well, so one of the issues is you have what are called comprehensive stroke centers, which are greater able to handle some of the most serious stroke cases. And then you have primary stroke centers. And currently in Columbus, there are two comprehensive stroke centers, Riverside Methodist Hospital, which is where this unit would be based at, and then Ohio State. I believe Mount Carmel East might also be working toward that status, but does not yet have that. And so you know, that can have an impact on, you know, where a patient goes potentially if they rework the protocols from taking a patient to the closest stroke center, primary stroke center.
Currently, how it works, or not?
I believe that I think it's a little more of a gray area than just that right now, but there hasn't been clearly established protocols to take it to a comprehensive stroke center.
So this caught other hospital systems off guard. They weren't expecting this. What's happening now? Is Ohio Health still moving forward with this?
My understanding is that Ohio Health is still intending to move forward with this. Ohio State said last week that they were happy to see that the project was being put on hold until everybody could sit at the table to talk about it.
I think
that might, you know, there can be some semantics at work there. I think there is definitely going to be a good faith effort to get everyone at the table, but I think this is far from resolved here in Columbus.
Dr. Russman, is this kind of protocol, these kinds of ambulances, is this something every community should have and must have?
Well, I think eventually this will become the norm in communities, but this is, as with any innovation, anytime some kind of innovative strategy comes out, there's always some early adoption or early adopters and then later adopters. And there are communities throughout the country that are launching similar units. Currently in the United States, there's Houston and Cleveland have units, but there are units in late stage development in Toledo, in Memphis, in Denver, and others that are also being developed. Throughout the world, there are currently only 4 active units, but there's 20 current units in development, and that's just currently this year. What we're going to see, much like we saw the development of more advanced cardiac types of care ambulances, we're going to see those, which started years ago, initially the same kind of concerns were raised about how patients were transported. Now it's the norm in EMS transport to have these types of units. Now, mobile stroke treatment will eventually be the norm, but this kind of early stage of innovation is often involves this kind of settling out of where people view how this will affect their own position, how this will affect their market share. But the refocusing still has to be from the municipality perspective on the patient, and that the citizens benefit from earlier treatment, and delivering that earlier treatment to them is something that we can do with these units, which is why eventually they'll become commonplace.
So, Ben Southerly, what is the role of Columbus Public Health in this? Are they leading the charge? How did it work that way?
The Columbus, it would be the Division of Public Safety, the fire division.
Gotcha.
And they, you know, again, are involved in the dispatching of medical units, so they, for the city of Columbus, oversee the protocols, and so they're a key player in all this. And again, Deputy Chief Jim Davis there had indicated to me, you know, when this impasse was reached that we discussed earlier, that he's willing to talk to anybody who's willing to come and brings forth a project that could improve stroke care in the community.
But otherwise, they're moving ahead with Ohio Health.
They have indicated late last week that they put the announcement out on Tuesday, but on Friday they suggested that they really want all three hospital systems to be at the table to increase the chances of this coming to fruition. So I wish I could give you a straight yes or no answer, but I haven't gotten that yet.
Gotcha. Dr. Russman, before we part, can you talk about how to assess if you're at risk for having a stroke, or maybe even more importantly for this conversation, how to recognize if you're having a stroke?
Well, we use some community education kinds of algorithms. One of the things we want people to know is a specific test we call the FAST test. And basically what this is the face, arm, speech, time test. And essentially we want somebody to look at their face and see, is the face drooping or is there a lack of symmetry from one side of the face to the other? Is one side not moving normally? To have them lift their arms and see whether one arm drifts down, or have somebody witness how their arms are moving. Ask them to talk and see if their speech seems fluent and crisp and clear. If these things are not present, we need to know when the time was they were last normal. Call 911 and activate this important system to deliver care to patients through 911 activation. So the best education we give people is you identify the possibility of these symptoms, you know the time, you dial 911.
And you tell them.
That's right. You tell them. You should not be transporting yourself to the emergency department. You should be dialing 911. Studies have shown that patients are treated faster, more efficiently when they call 911 than when they try private auto transport to the emergency department.
Okay. Well, Dr. Andrew Russman, thanks for joining us today. Really appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
It's Dr. Andrew Russman. He's a neurologist at the Cleveland Clinic, where they are using specialized ambulances to improve the outcomes for stroke patients who call them. Also with us, Ben Southerly from the Columbus Dispatch, who's been covering this issue in Central Ohio. Thanks, Ben, for joining us.
You're welcome.
More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Guzzling down a frosty brewski after a workout might appear counterproductive, but there is a connection between exercise and alcohol. A couple of recent studies look into the relationship between cocktails and conditioning. Joining us now by phone to talk about that and other fitness news is phys ed columnist for the New York Times Well blog, Gretchen Reynolds. Welcome back, Gretchen.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what were some of the problems from previous studies that looked at people who imbibe and their exercising habits?
Well, there have been a lot of pretty large epidemiological studies that have found a link between people who exercise and people who drink, basically that they overlap. People who exercise tended to also be people who drank. But none of those studies actually looked at, for instance, whether people drank and exercised on the same days. They would just say, oh, you know, you answered, yes, I exercise, yes, I drink. But this new study actually had people keep diaries for, you know, three-week periods and several three-week periods in which they would discuss or they would write down whether and how much they exercised and whether and how much they drank any kind of alcohol. and it usually was beer, but it could be any type of alcohol counted. And then the researchers looked at whether they tended to both exercise and drink on the same days. And they did, pretty consistently. And this was a very large group of people from college age all the way up through retirement age. And there was, it didn't matter. It didn't matter whether it was a man or a woman, and it didn't matter what age. The more someone exercised on any given day, the more likely they were to also drink on that day.
You know, it's interesting because the more I read about this, the more I thought about like doing warrior dashes and those kind of events where a big part of that is you get a beer at the end of it.
Absolutely. And there's other evidence that, you know, humans, we humans often join the two because we apparently get a buzz from both of them.
Mm-hmm.
People seem to, you know, if you like exercise, you generally are getting a little bit of a buzz, what they call a reward sensation from exercise. And that can lead you right into drinking, which also gives you a little bit even more of a reward sensation. If, on the other hand, you really don't like exercising all that much, many people seem to use a beer or a glass of wine to reward themselves for having done what they didn't really enjoy. So it can work either way, but there does seem to be a really strong relationship between exercising and a moderate amount of alcohol. We're not talking about problem drinking.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be that, you know, people exercise moderately and then they drink moderately. And it may be because they are going out for a beer with their friends. It may be because they like a glass of wine to reward themselves for going to, you know, the exercise class.
Mm-hmm.
It may be because it is lighting up the same parts of their brain. That's not completely clear yet, but it does seem that people like to both exercise and have a beer.
And reward aside, is it counterproductive physically to do that?
It does not appear to be. There's no evidence that people are, for instance, drinking so much that they completely undercut their attempts to lose weight, which would seem to be, you know, would be one of the disadvantages. It may well be that if someone exercises and then has two beers, they feel guilty enough that they exercise again the next day, which they might not have done. So there's no link, at least so far, between, say, drinking two beers and undercutting all of your exercise resolutions.
I don't even want to talk about resolutions right now. How much exercise should we be getting a week, you know, drinkers or not? I mean, what's the latest on that?
If you're talking about, for instance, how much running someone should do for health, which is what I wrote about recently, it's an amazingly small amount. There was a pretty big review of past studies of running and health, and it was looking at how little you can do and still get substantial health benefits. And the answer was about between 3 and 6 miles a week. That means over the course of an entire week, and at a pretty low pace. So people in most of these studies were running between 10, 12 miles or minutes per mile,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, a pretty easy jogging mm-hmm. pace. But even that little amount of exercise was shown to pretty substantially reduce both the possibility of gaining weight. Most of these people maintained their weight, and they had a substantially reduced risk of all sorts of chronic diseases. So what the researchers found was a very small amount of running, and this was looking at running, not mm-hmm. walking, had a really substantial effect on people's health.
So even if it was just a mile a day?
Exactly.
It doesn't have to be all at the same time.
No, not at all. Although there was some indication that going out for twice a week was better than only once.
Okay.
And that may just be because it means you're not sitting around quite as much if you go out twice a week. But what they found was for the maximal amount of sort of health benefit per mile, it maxed out at about 6 miles a week, which does not mean you can't do more. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons to run or walk or do anything more than that. And they did not find a dangerous upper limit. There are some concerns that, you know, people who are doing ultra marathons are putting themselves at risk. In this big review of a lot of studies, they did not find that to be true. It did not increase people's risk for health problems, no matter how much they did. But you don't get more health bang after about 6 miles.
Yeah, it's just whatever kind of buzz you're getting at that point.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
And I mean, I don't know about you. You're still out in New Mexico, right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
I may be more there than here. I don't know, but I'm seeing a lot more of the 26.1 and 13 point whatever it is stickers on people's cars. It just seems like it's running those long distances is becoming more and more common, more and more popular.
Yeah, maybe, although the fields for marathon races are not really going up a lot right now. They're not going down, but they're not expanding enormously. I do think that, especially this time of year, people start looking at their lifetime bucket lists, and a lot of people would like to do one marathon in their life, and a lot of people do. And if you want to do a marathon, there's absolutely no evidence that it's harmful, which some people worry about. As long as you train slowly, build up with your mileage, mm-hmm. it's unlikely to hurt your heart. It's unlikely to be in any way dangerous. There's also no reason that you have to do a marathon.
Yay!
If you want to be healthy, if you want to live a long life, doing considerably less exercise is going to be beneficial, as long as you do something.
Mm-hmm. Which is why we have you on our show periodically, because you give us great ideas. One thing you've written about recently is counting your bites for weight loss. Now, I don't even want to tell you how fast I eat. I'm terrible about it. But I know that people do sit and chew and count. What's going on there?
Well, this study was actually done because a group of scientists who worked with at Brigham Young University in Utah, who worked with people who were trying to lose weight, found that absolutely across the board, every single one of those people hated counting calories, just hated it. And I don't blame them. I hate it.
Uh-huh.
It means, for one thing, you have to pay attention to the size of your food. Yep. You have to know how many calories are in every type of food. You have to weigh it, all sorts of things. So the scientists were looking for an easy, relatively easy way for people to reduce their food intake, essentially reduce the number of calories they were taking in without having to know, you know, calories in cheese versus calories in dessert. So they said to these people, for a week, count every time you take a bite, and that includes swallowing any liquid but water. Just count them, mark them down, keep track of it, don't change anything, just count how many times you take a bite. They added all of that up, and then they asked the people to reduce the number of bites they took each day by either 20% or 30%. They didn't say change your food, they didn't say do anything except pay attention to how many times you take a bite and take fewer. And within a month, the people had lost usually between 3 and 5 pounds, which is, you know, a good return.
That's pretty good.
On that dieting. And what was interesting was whether it was 20% or 30% reduction, they lost the same amount, which suggested to the scientists that cutting your bites by 20% was the best way to reduce weight. And they did not tell the people change your eating habits, but they did find that people tended to eat more fruits and vegetables, probably because you take more bites of those. They were just paying more attention without being told to.
Uh-huh.
And they, most of them told the researchers that they thought they could keep doing this. And as of right now, apparently are still counting their bites. So it's a relatively easy way to reduce how much you eat without having to, you know, constantly check your phone for the calorie counts and all these types of foods.
Right. I mean, it goes directly to the issue of portions.
Yes, exactly, which is what we really need to be paying attention to. And none of us like any of that. And, you know, you go out and go for a run and you can eat a little bit more, but you can't eat a huge amount more. So no matter what, if you want to maintain or lose weight, you have to pay attention to how much you are eating.
When I first heard about this, I thought it was going to be more about slowing down your eating. But it's kind of about kind of almost a mindfulness sort of exercise, too.
It is a mindfulness in terms of, you know, you're not necessarily, they weren't told to pay attention to, you know, the taste or anything. It was strictly a numerical thing, which some people may find easier. You just literally are counting how many times you move your jaw.
Or how many bites you take, or it's how many times you chew.
Yes, it's how many times you chew. Although if you're drinking, obviously, it's how many you
swallows.
Count the swallowing. And they said you count everything except water. And that would include beer.
Even after exercising.
Exactly.
You also have talked about intuitive eating. Tell us what we mean by that.
Well, intuitive eating is a form, basically, of mindful eating. It's a program in which they tell people just, you know, don't worry about the food at all. Only pay attention to cues from your body. Pay attention to the taste and sensation of eating. And this was a different study that I also wrote about where they compared that kind of intuitive eating, which is not bite counting. It's really paying attention to, am I hungry? Am I enjoying this food? If I'm not hungry, I shouldn't eat. They compared that kind of program to very straightforward calorie counting. They had one group of people do intuitive eating for a month, and they had the other group cut their daily calories. I think it was to about between 1,200 and 1,500 calories a day, which is a pretty substantial reduction for a lot of people. And then they just sent them off for a month. And what happened was the intuitive eating people started out very well. They lost a decent amount of weight in the first 2 weeks, and then their weight loss, for the most part, stopped. And it looks like, you know, they stuck to the intuitive eating for about 2 weeks, and then they went back to eating exactly the way they ate before. And the implication is that we do need to pay attention to portion size. It's the same lesson. And it appears that if you want to do that, it may be better to try something very straightforward like bite counting as opposed to paying attention to signals from your body, because it may be that we stop paying attention to those as soon as we don't like them.
You know, I interviewed a physician some months ago who suggested that our devotion to the breakfast meal is oversold. It's not, you know, and I started to pay attention to my body and realized I wasn't really that hungry in the morning, and I've stopped eating breakfast for the most part. Except maybe on the weekends after I've worked out, right? And it's helped.
That's another issue. There's a lot of controversy about whether eating early in the morning actually matters, and it does seem to differ very differently from person to person.
Yeah,
there definitely are what they call chronotypes, which means that your body is more or less ready for food at various times of the day. And it does make sense to pay attention to when you are hungry. I mean, that is intuitive. The problem with using intuitive eating to guide your weight loss, at least in this study, and this was among a group of people who were overweight but who did want to lose weight, is that they didn't seem to stick with it very well over the long term.
Okay.
And it may just be not hard-headed enough. It may not have, you know, the enough of a guideline about how much to eat. It may be the researchers I talked to said it may well be that intuitive eating, in terms of paying attention to when you are hungry, is very important. But you also have to look at how much you're eating.
Gretchen Reynolds, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.